clouds. At any rate, spring is here, even in London N1, and they can't stop you enjoying it. This is a satisfying reflection. How many a time have I stood watching the toads mating, or a pair of hares having a boxing match in the young corn, and thought of all the important persons who would stop me enjoying this if they could. But luckily, they can't. The atom bombs are piling up in the factories. The police are prowling through the cities. The lies are streaming from the loudspeakers. But the earth is still going round the sun, and neither the dictators nor the bureaucrats, deeply as they disapprove of the process, are able to prevent it. George Orwell. First stop, the skate park. It was a school morning, so I had the place to myself. I amused myself for a while riding up and down the ramps on my bike, except for the steepest one, which was too scary. The fields were still damp with morning dew when I'd finished mucking about, sparkling with a million tiny diamonds. The fleeting beauty of these shining droplets, each with an upside-down image of the world hanging within it, led to early superstitions. It was said that the dew on the 1st of May had magical properties that bestowed a flawless complexion on anyone who washed their face with it. A rhyme suggested that a maid who rises early on May Day and washes in dew from the hawthorn tree will ever after handsome be. The diarist, Samuel Pepys, recorded his wife travelling out from London to the countryside in Woolwich at the end of April 1667, ready to collect May dew, which Mrs. Turner hath taught her is the only thing in the world to wash her face with. Variants of the formula suggested that the May dew had to come from ivy or perhaps the grass beneath oak trees, but everyone agreed it worked best at sunrise. So some people stayed out all night to catch the first dew. There may have been additional motives at play here, with the Puritan Philip Stubbs harumphing in 1583 that out of all the young women who spent May Day Eve in the woods, scarcely the third part of them return home again undefiled. The roadside verges were growing thicker and greener every week. Oxeye daisies waved in the draught of passing cars. I nibbled a few leaves of garlic mustard, also known as Jack by the Hedge, and a nice addition to salads or when cooking fish or meat. In Somerset folklore, it was said that rubbing the fresh leaves onto your feet relieved cramp, though whether or not they were then added to the salad is unknown. Another abundant plant this week was Galium aperine, better known by kids as cleavers, clivers, catchweed, sticky bob, sticky bud, sticky willy, sticky willow, sticky jack, sticklejack, grip grass, goose grass, robin run the hedge, bobby buttons or whippy sticks. Ancient Greek shepherds used the hairy stems of this plant to make rough sieves to strain milk. The botanist Carl Linnaeus reported the same thing in Sweden, while elsewhere in Europe, the dried foliage was used for stuffing mattresses. I still haven't grown out of finding it amusing to drape strands of sticky weed onto friends' backs when out walking. A slap on the back and a hearty, "Mate, it's lovely to be out here with you," is all it takes to do the deed and transfer the weed. Today's Grid Square was a land of expensive houses, double garages and lawns with fountains and sculptures. One garden had a tall monkey puzzle tree. Next door was a splendid cedar. They always remind me of the flag of Lebanon and my time cycling through the mountains there. When Lebanon gained its independence from France in 1943, the country adopted a white flag with two red stripes and a green cedar tree. The white represented peace and purity, while the red stripes were a reminder of so much bloodshed. This, though, was only the latest in a line of thousands of years of flags in the region. 5 millennia ago, the flag was blue and red. Then came the Tanuk tribe's white, blue, yellow, red, green, vertical banded flag, followed by the Abbasid Caliphate's plain black one. At other times, between then and now, a white flag with a golden cross, a banner of diagonal white and red with a laurel wreath, a plain yellow flag, a yellow flag with a left-facing crescent moon, a blue flag and a right-facing crescent, a red flag with a white moon and star, a white flag with a green cedar tree, a French tricolour with a green cedar, another with a black one, and a third with a brown trunk and green leaves. It's useful for your sense of perspective to reflect on the impermanence of everything we consider fixed, such as enormous cedar trees, landscapes, national flags, or, indeed, nations. Meanwhile, the monkey puzzle tree next door to the cedar hailed from Chile. They were first brought to Britain in 1795 as ornaments. Their distinctive spiky branches have defended the tree from grazing animals for 200 million years, though these days it is jays and squirrels that feast on the nuts rather than dinosaurs, and the monkey puzzle is now endangered in the wild. 8,400 miles away from Lebanon and its cedar tree flag, Chile sports a white and red horizontal stripe and a blue square with a white star on its flag. Once again, it wasn't always thus, and I wonder what will come next. The first flag flown in what is now Chile was the Mapuche war flag, blue, with a distinctive white star called a Gunyelvi. That flag fell to the invading Spaniards' saw-toothed Burgundy cross, and the conquerors ruled Chile beneath their national flag until 1812. Upon winning independence, Chile adopted a blue, white and yellow tricolour, nicknamed Patria Vieja. Over the next century, various modifications came and went until 1934, when they plumped for the design still used today. Flagging from all this vexillography, or flag design, I rode into a village with old brick cottages and grand houses clustered around two appealing pubs. It's too early, Al, it's too early. One house was called the Old Chemist and another the Old Butcher's, reminders of the changes in village life over the centuries. Today's occupants were more likely to work in an office in the city, have meat delivered from a supermarket, and buy medicines online from a warehouse on a distant grid square. An antique watch restorer had a studio in the village, and he shared my blossoming interest in random stuff. A note in the display window asked, "Does anyone know what these pliers were used for? Let me know if you do. Thanks. Mark." A peculiar spiky object had a note that asked simply, "What is this?" The mystery had been solved, and an update on the note gave the details. "Thanks to a customer, I can now tell you that this is a larding needle used to inject fat into lean meat. Look up larding and barding. Best wishes, Mark." Okay, Mark, I shall. Larding beef means to artificially marble the meat with fat. The fat is introduced in the beef's cut using a larding needle. The fat injected can be beef fat or, more likely, pork fat. Barding beef involves wrapping the meat in two or more strips of fat, which have the purpose of protecting the meat from drying. There are people who confuse larding beef with barding beef, but the difference is very clear. Very clear. I pedalled out of the village and away from the madness of becoming engrossed in every single thing my eyes fell upon. A grassy byway led towards a triangle of woodland by the motorway. Mighty oak trees sported their first flourish of unfurling green leaves, and a little wren blasted out its surprisingly loud song. For their size, wrens are 10 times louder than cockerels. Birds can produce much greater sounds than we can because they use the syrinx at the bottom of their windpipe. It is surrounded by a resonating air sac chamber that amplifies the sounds, unlike our larynx. The syrinx is also often double-barreled, which helps to produce more complex sounds than we can manage. It would be like us being able to play both a trumpet and a tin whistle at the same time, with each lung blowing a separate instrument. A footpath led through the wood and crossed the motorway via a narrow pedestrian footbridge. The Samaritan's Charity had fixed signs to the bridge to try to reach anyone feeling suicidal. Talk to us. We'll listen. Whatever you're going through, you don't have to face it alone. In 1953, Chad Farrar, a vicar and writer-cartoonist, began answering phone calls from suicidal people on a helpline he set up. He worked all day, then stayed up late into the night taking calls in between writing scripts and cartoons. The Samaritans has grown so much since then that it now responds to a call for help every 10 seconds, which I find both inspiring and heartbreaking. Over the motorway, heathland stretched towards the tall fences of a quarry. Once again, I realised that I was hurrying for no reason, so I chose to notice that the sky was a deep blue and that the white clouds were scudding along in high altitude winds. I lay down in the grass and gazed up for a few minutes. The sun felt pleasant on my face as I studied the clouds and imagined the shapes I could see, just like Hamlet in his famous exchange with Polonius. "Do you see yonder cloud that's almost in shape of a camel?" asked Hamlet. "By the mass, and 'tis like a camel indeed. Methinks it is like a weasel. It is backed like a weasel, or like a whale, very like a whale." If you also enjoy clouds, like Polonius, Hamlet, and myself, you can join the Cloud Appreciation Society. Annual membership, just £25. The quarry was a chasm gouged 20 metres down into the earth, equivalent to a mind-boggling number of sandcastles, excavated for building sand, topsoil, southern side sand, equestrian sand, reject sand and silica sand. To pick just a couple of these specialised categories of dirt, silica sand has been used in glassmaking for thousands of years and was a vital component of the Industrial Revolution. Topsoil, the first layer to be excavated in a quarry, is high in organic matter and invaluable for growing plants. Indeed, it's one of the most important and underrated components of life on Earth. Almost 4 million hectares of soil are at risk of compaction in England and Wales, and 2 million hectares are at risk of erosion. Intensive agriculture has caused arable soils to lose up to 60% of their organic carbon, and soil degradation costs us over £1 billion every year. If we continue to neglect soil, losing it far faster than it is created, then the world could run out of topsoil within 60 years, with disastrous consequences. To repair the soil upon which we depend, we must shift our farming systems to ones that use less fertiliser, reduce ploughing, and use cover crops and crop rotation. Looking down into the quarry, it jarred that a man-made hole had literally reshaped the landscape. I'm familiar with towns and roads, so that reshaping doesn't look shocking to me anymore. But this vast hole on my grid square prompted a small nudge in my awareness about our endless desire for development and the impact this has had on every square of my map.